Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Community Geek Podcast. This is Greg Russo, here with my co-host for the evening, Callum Keekley.
Hello.
Callum is another Fever Bee employee. He runs the course, the community management training course we have. Very excellent thing. If you haven't signed up for it, look into it. It's pretty decent. I've sat in on a couple of the guest speakers, and they're pretty fantastic. So we brought Callum in for the day because Richard is in San Francisco, and Darren unavailable. Mike unavailable. So it's me and Callum holding down the fort today.
Got to set up for me, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the C squad, but it's all right. We love him anyway. So a little bit of site news before we get into everything else. Michael and I mentioned a referral program a bit earlier. We're still working on that. It's not going to be anything like super complicated, but we do want to give you guys the ability to invite your friends and colleagues to the site to make Community Geek a little bit larger. I think we're pretty keen to have like another 10 or so members in the next couple weeks. That would be a good target for us. So if you want to help us contribute to that goal, we would really appreciate it, and we're going to give you guys the tools to do so. Callum, talk to us a little bit about what I'm hearing about a Fever Bee event, possibly. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so this is exciting. We did VeerCon back in February, and it was a huge success. It was the first time we'd ever done an event, so we weren't doing it blind. We knew what we wanted to achieve, but there are obviously challenges that you don't expect to come up. So looking forward to doing a second event with that experience behind us is exciting. And I think it's a great opportunity to show everyone what Fever Bee has to offer by way of like our best practices. And I think mainly our approach, and I think that's what will make the event successful, is the approach that Fever Bee has, which is kind of the no-nonsense, no-glitzy kind of, this is the theory behind how something works. This is the science. We understand that, and we can apply it to different situations so people can actually leave the event with directly useful tips that they can take straight on Monday morning and apply to their jobs. I think a lot of events, you get these speakers who are really charismatic, and they're from these cool big companies, which is useful. It's fun to watch, but it's not useful. That's the point. So it's fun to see these people, but then you kind of left thinking, what did I actually take away from that talk? And we want people to be able to answer that question just by clicking their fingers at our kind of event. So it's exciting. It's going to be a lot of work, but, I will keep everyone posted as developments come through.
I'm excited about that as well, because a lot of times you leave those talks and you're like, okay, well, all that sounded good. And then you sit down and you're thinking about how to actually make use of it. And then you're sort of sitting there like, oh, well, now what? Like, how am I going to apply this to my own circumstance? What's a concrete series of actions that I can take? What's a specific set of questions I can ask of my community or my team or my... in some cases, my boss, to get a better direction of where we're supposed to be going on this. And if you can't do that, then really, what's the point?
I was listening to Jack Shepard speak from BuzzFeed last week, and it was a really good talk. It was interesting, and he did give you actionable things. I'll give that to him. Like it was a useful talk, but you could take things away. But at one stage, someone said, I work in like the financial services sector. I can't really make posts about cats. How do I write engaging content? And he answered the question. It was interesting, but I agree with you. That's what people want. They want to hear about the cool, exciting stories, but everyone also wants to be able to take something away and apply it to their specific job. And of course, you've got to be able to justify to your boss why they sent you over there and gave you a day off work so you could go to this conference.
And are you able to say what areas we're looking at for this, or what kind of time frame? Is this going to be a summer thing, a fall thing?
Yeah, so I think in terms of time frame, we're looking around October. With events, you always have to research and just double, triple, quadruple check that you're not making a huge error and booking booking it on the same day as like a school holiday or another event. So finding the right time is something that I've been working on, and we'll finalize that over the next week. And in terms of the areas that we want to discuss, it's going to be what Rich has been focusing on quite a lot. So he gave a talk last week, and I went to as well, which was about how to build addictive communities. So it's looking at how you can be scientific and what metrics you can use or should use to make sure that you get people into the habit of visiting your community and make that community addictive. And we'll be looking at the psychology behind communities as well, I think. So those are the things that we're looking at, and we'll as we find speakers. So I think Rich has got a few ideas. I don't want to say any names now. A, to keep it a surprise, and B, because not everyone's confirmed. But we're going to get some fantastic people speaking, just because, I don't know, we're lucky because we've worked with such a range of companies and cool people. I think it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, it's cool. We've got a lot of contacts to draw from for good speakers.
Yeah.
And are we going to have something a little extra in the event for community geek people? Has that been discussed?
Obviously we want to reward our community geeks. So that has been discussed, but again, nothing's been finalized. So maybe it would be good if we can have another chat in like 2 or 3 weeks. And I'll be able to give you a lot more information about the event then. But at the moment it's to the exciting stage, but also the kind of hectic stage where you're trying to bring in all these ideas and tie them into like a clear-cut plan. So that's my job at the moment.
Well, I will say this, that if we do have an event and I'm at all involved in helping to plan or execute it, I'll make sure there's going to be something. There's going to be something. Might not be a big thing. Could be just getting some drinks or whatever. But you know, I'll make sure that there's something for the community geeks that show up to the Fever Bee event, because you know we got to look out for each other.
We do. That's an idea.
All right, so we're going to get into our first of two stories for the podcast today. An online community was launched for British families that don't have kids, either by circumstance or by choice. These are childrenless couples. And that can be somewhat isolating for people, especially if it's not by choice. That can be a very frustrating and heartbreaking thing for a family. And we thought that this story would contrast pretty well to the Facebook story that we talked about last week, where Facebook is trying to, you know, capture more of a children's audience and incorporate these parental controls to try to get younger and younger children into their site. And we had an interesting conversation with Darren about how he sees his role as a parent. And to counterbalance that, I wanted to bring up this community for people that are facing a different set of issues with regards to children. The site is called nonparents.com. Which I think that's a pretty clever term. And their target audience is apparently about 7.5 million families in the UK alone. So that's a much larger group than you would think. I don't have kids. Callum doesn't have kids. So we're enjoying the single life, Darren. I don't know if you can handle that, but yeah. I haven't really, you know, I haven't decided whether or not I'm going to have kids yet, so maybe I'll fall into this group at some point. And it's good to know that there's a community out there for people that are looking at those issues. Not glamorizing it like, oh, you're young and you're single, you don't have kids. These are for people that are together but are making the decision or just simply can't have kids. And there's some issues there, including one thing they talked about, which I thought was pretty profound. A way to create legacies without offspring. So that's a fascinating concept. That's really powerful.
Yeah, that's interesting. One thing for me that I initially thought when I was reading through this was it's interesting that you, as you were saying, there's people who are childless out of circumstance and people who are childless out of choice. And the thing about this community is that you're mixing those two people together. And they are two groups that can probably learn from each other, because I think in terms, and this also ties into the legacy thing, you know, it's the meaning of life, why we're alive, to procreate, have children. But some people decide that it's not for them and they'd rather just not have kids. And then other people that can be really challenging for because they can't have kids. But it's something that is really important to them and they believe it's almost like the reason for their being on this earth. So it's interesting that those two groups can talk, because while they might disagree, so you've got one group that really thinks children are the most important thing, they can't have them. Then you've got another group who say, I think children are, you know, they're not for me. I don't want to have them. So they can maybe kind of learn different things from each other, which is an interesting matching.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, the couples that are going through this by choice, they can maybe offer an alternative perspective to the couples that don't have the children because they can't have them. And the children and those couples can then in turn help the couples that are not having children by choice maybe appreciate, you know, what they're giving up and understand that choice a bit better. So I could see that easily the other way too, that maybe these groups conflict in some ways, but I think by bringing them together in this context, you're really getting the best out of them and the best out of that mix. Wish them well. It's nonparents.com. Shout out to their founder, Nina Steele. And, yeah, maybe we'll follow up on the story at some point and see how they're doing. It's been around for almost a year now. It'll be a year in November. So that first year is very critical for an online community. So we'll see how they're getting on.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Do you know much about their how many active members they have?
It's not included in this article that I can...
No, I can see it either. No, as you say, it's something to come back to. Interesting.
Another thing we want to talk about is it's one of these great articles that sort of boils down five key takeaways from something. In this case, it's a discussion of Link, the social media conference. And I thought these were five pretty good takeaways that we could discuss on the show. So the first is the idea that, and this is an article by Jonathan Bacon, by the way. The first is that social is the new search. Now, I don't know that I buy this one. This is the claim that social media traffic is now outweighing the search engine in terms of primary direct to people's sites. I think this is a little bit colored by the person that gave this particular talk. In this case, it was someone from BuzzFeed. And if you're not familiar with BuzzFeed, think like 10 greatest celebrities you'll never believe are secretly horrible or something like that. It's one of those type sites. Those types of articles, yeah, I could see them getting shared socially pretty quickly because they come out, it's a very click inviting article, it's quick, people look at it, oh, that's fun, I'll share it. So they share it. And then it's neither here nor there. It's certainly not going to be like the top search listing for something. On the other hand, most people will rather search for something than go directly to a website in a lot of cases. They'll just search for it and then click whatever the thing is. We noticed this in University of Michigan when I was working on their website as an intern. People, instead of like going to a website and then clicking the map page, for instance, they would just search in Google University of Michigan maps and then go directly right there. I don't think that behavior is changing. If anything, I think that's becoming more established.
I agree with that. I think that's interesting what you were just saying. And that kind of tied into the way that if you look at Safari, for example, you used to have the space where you typed in the URL and then you had a different box on the right where you could Google things. Now it's just one bar. And I think that's sort of highlights what you were just saying, is that people type in what they want, and then the search engine provides it, rather than going directly to a website.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's pretty good. And yeah, you can see some search engines are incorporating or trying to incorporate either Google Plus or Facebook or Twitter or a combination into their search results. And I think that is also a positive thing. But I just don't think that social is the new search to me is a stronger claim that I'm willing to support.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I think if you're sharing content that's going to sort of distract people from their jobs, which I think BuzzFeed is always all over my social media things on a Friday afternoon when everyone's maybe had a bit much of work and they're just sharing silly things around on the internet. You can see how that content specifically and the way that it appeals to people's emotions, whether that's because it's cute cats or something like that. You can see how successful that would be in it, and it makes sense, but I don't think it necessarily translates into everything else. I think there are some principles that you can take away from it and try and get to work, but I don't think it will be guaranteed the same success rate because people do things because they genuinely want to do them. If people are doing this because it's fun, so you can't make everything fun.
Or you can't make everything fun all the time.
Yeah.
Like, you can do 10 most horrific battles in Iraq, but that's not going to carry for, like, every article that you make on, say, a foreign policy website or a defense policy website for the entire year. And that's just not going to... It's not going to work out for your target audience. You have to keep that sort of thing in mind. And there's nothing wrong with incorporating certain types of that. Like, if going along the same vein, an article that might be great on a site like that, 10 worst foreign policy blunders in the past decade or something like that. That's a cool article. But you can't have that every day because that just wouldn't fly with that audience.
Some people don't want to be reading, doing like a quiz or reading through those like 25 best whatevers. They want to sometimes go on to, so if everyone started doing it, people would lose their credibility and their values. So say, I think The Guardian does, the whole, digital journalism online community thing quite well. It's quite an interesting thing to look at, but people go on there because they have the opportunity to comment underneath articles, but then in terms of the way they've been attracted, yes, to some extent, like headlines are supposed to draw you in to read it. They always have. But you wouldn't want it to be that kind of like, it's just a different thing, like more BuzzFeed thing. It's not as serious. Sometimes you want to read something serious. You want to get into a real serious discussion about it.
But that's it. Sometimes your serious stuff can get shared too.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't want to discount the value of social network, which sort of ties into the next point, which is the rise of super fans, which is, you know, your really hardcore audience. These are the guys that are you can think of them as brand evangelists. They love your product. They love your people. They love what you do. And they're talking about your stuff all the time to everyone who will listen. These are guys like, if you put out some kind of music, they're the guys remixing your stuff. If you're putting out videos, they're putting out tributes or music videos based on it. Or they're writing original stories for your characters. If you're, you know, a Red Bull type company or you're any kind of product where you really rely on sort of that brand marketing, they're the guys that are buying caseloads and giving it out at parties. These guys are the guys that are going to be the main social media advocates for you. And the Sony has an interesting... I think this is probably the most interesting part of this entire section of the article. Although we do have soft key performance indicators around sales, our main KPIs are completely non-sales driven. Engaged page views, how deep people go, and the number of superfans we have, the extent of our reach. So they're not even, I mean, now obviously Sony is a huge company. They're probably not as worried about every little cent in their bottom line as maybe a startup or someone that has a bit of a tighter budget. But it is interesting that they're not really focused on measuring every single penny ROI. They just want to get as many of these super fans as possible because these fans are promoting, it's basically free advertising, free authentic advertising. It's the kind of word of mouth spread for their products that a lot of companies dream of. That's cool.
Yeah. It is. It's interesting. I think you have to be careful with things like this, though. And I think it's why lots of community managers in specific types of communities struggle to explain their value to their executives, explain why they should be earning that amount of money, how much they're contributing to the company. So while you can say that it's completely to me, saying something's completely non-sales driven sounds like a bit of a contradiction, because largely that's why would you want to create more and more super fans? Because they're going to keep buying stuff off you. Like that, the end goal is sales. I still think whatever it's being put underneath.
I think the distinction is it's not a direct tie. In other words, you're not putting out this piece of content because you want it to convert 10 sales for whatever product it's talking about. What you're trying to do is convert 10 people, because down the line, over time, the theory is they'll spread to more people, or they'll buy more later products, perhaps. It's less of a focus on that immediate exchange. I'm doing something, and then I'm getting the immediate sale off that. It's sort of a delayed satisfaction.
Yeah. It's also a culture thing. So this is always the kind of example of community that I use when I try and explain to people what I do, because it's always the hardest thing. So you go to a party and people say, oh, what do you do? And it's like, oh, I work in online communities. And they look at you and go, ah, what's that? Like Facebook, yeah? And you say, no, not really. I say, you can have lots of different types. Charities have them. But you also get branded communities that aren't necessarily around a brand, because people don't want to go and talk about Coca-Cola on the internet. That's not interesting. But they might want to go and talk about their favorite soft drinks. So it's a really interesting area. And I think that it gives the companies so much rich information about their customers that they'd never be able to extract in any different way. However many customer, focus groups they did, they'd never get this information, because they can actually understand through looking at the community, the language that community uses, the culture of that community. They can really get to the core of their customers. That might be something's quite worrying to some people, that companies now have the ability to really get to know their customers on quite a personal and individual level. But for the company, from their perspective, it's a useful tool.
And it's a bit different. You say it's a bit worrying. It's a bit worrying that they can try to do that without your consent. In other words, like through various information sales and tracking your online activity, they can build a profile of what you like and how you interact and all that stuff. But with the community, it's a different dynamic, right? This is something you want to be a part of. You're eager to share your perspective, your experience, your connection to the product or connection to a culture around that product or that product is involved in. And in that way, I think you can get a deeper understanding of the motivations behind the actions. And I think that's more valuable information than what someone's searching for on Amazon.
Yeah, agreed.
But if you want your customers to be honest with you, you've got to be a little honest with them, which leads into our third point. Be yourself in social media. Can't stress this enough for companies. I'm a huge guy on Twitter. I think of all the platforms, I like Facebook because it lets me talk to friends and family. But in terms of using social network to build a network beyond what I already have, for me, it's Twitter. Twitter is where it's at. I love the format. I love the people on it. It's a great place to get content, to share content, and you can have conversations at the same time. I love it. Big Twitter guy. When people run into problems, a lot of times, especially when you're talking about companies or politicians in particular, they have other people writing their tweets. Now, of course, writing your own tweets can be an equal big pitfall, if you're very careless with them. But on the other hand, people can identify pretty easily, especially nowadays, now that everyone's familiar with social media, It's become very mainstream. Everyone's, if they don't do it, they know people that do it. They know what it looks like, what it sounds like. They can tell if your marketing department is writing your Twitter account. They can tell if your employees aren't allowed to talk on Twitter except by, like, approved statements and things like that. It's obvious. You're not clever. People know. If you want to have a more genuine engagement on social media, and especially in your private community, you need to let your employees be themselves a little bit. Let your community managers talk with their own voice. Now, obviously, you're going to have concerns about your brand, concerns about how you're communicating. Train your staff, by all means, but also trust your staff to engage in an authentic way with the people in your community, because that's what they're there for. They're not there to be fake with you. They don't want you to be fake with them. You got to make a genuine connection. And a lot of times, some of the most compelling, heartwarming, effective things you see out of online communities and social networking are things that are a little weird or out of the box, but also really awesome. Like if one of your active community members gets hit by a motorcycle or something, you guys, maybe your community managers, like, send him a big box of stuff, and he gets it, and he takes pictures of it, and he shares it with everybody, and it brings a level of emotional engagement to the community that wouldn't otherwise be there. What's the ROI for sending him a get well box? Probably not tons, but it brings the community together. And that's, in a lot of ways, the ability to do that is very tricky. You can spend a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of wasted man hours trying to do what a simple act of genuine human connection can get done in an instant.
Yeah, I agree. This is interesting. So I saw last week, I saw Morgan Evans from Etsy give a talk. And I think that trust you were talking about of trusting your staff to be themselves is very interesting. I think it ties into company culture. So that's what you want to be presenting to people, is that the people that work for that you're real people that work for you, and that's the ability that you can garner through social media and through online communities, is that people sort of often don't realize that there are genuine people working at this company. That's interesting. And if they see that you work in an environment where, for example, you're sustainable, you mess around and have a good time, but it's just like happy, fun people, then that can translate quite well by letting people be honest. So it kind of ties into actually creating that culture at your company as well. And then I think that gives you the trust.
And I got to give a shout out to Moz here. We brought them in for one of the course talks. And I think the way that their employees are able to communicate in a sort of off-color, very genuine way with their community is really integral to their culture. And I think they've had some excellent results as a direct correspondent to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Definitely look up Jennifer Lopez from Moz. Not only a fantastic name, but also she's got some really interesting, I think it's all available on SlideShare actually, lots of her stuff, definitely worth a look, really interesting. And yeah, I agree, she gave a great talk.
Fourth, control the conversation. This is the idea of, you know, don't, if there's going to be disagreement, if there's going to be a negative review of your product, you want to be able to face it head on. I agree with this, pretty handedly, actually. I don't think you need to control the conversation in an aggressive way. Like, for instance, you'll see a lot of restaurants make this misstep where they'll get negative reviews on Yelp, and then they'll go onto Yelp and try to get those reviews taken down, or they'll fire back at that customer, accusing them of you know, being rude or being very defensive. That comes off very poorly. What they mean by control the conversation is, these reviews are going to happen. Give a place for your customers to come to you with it. Invite that kind of honesty, even if it's negative, so that if you do get a negative conversation, you can address it. You're aware of it. You can, you know, go to that person via back channel and see if you can address their concerns. And, you know, nothing is better than a customer that comes on and says, hey, I had a really bad experience with blank blank. But then, you know, one of their guys contacted me and they worked through my issues. And, you know, now I'm a much more satisfied customer. They fixed all the problems that I had. These guys are really tremendous. Their customer service is unbeatable. That is a good review. If you can get from, man, this product was terrible, to this product, I thought this product was terrible, but then my experience with the sales staff, you know, was extremely positive. They helped me out with all the issues that I was experiencing, and, you know, my issue was taken care of. Thank you very much. That's a huge switch. And you're not going to be able to get that if people are going to a third-party forum to basically join other people that are negative about your product in dumping on your product.
Yeah, it's this is one of those things. I think it's like the first most important thing I learned about online communities. Things I kind of used to work doing more like social media stuff before I came to Fever-B. But it was just so many people forget. They see the internet, and they see technology, and they see this online community thing, and they think, ah, I don't know how to do this. It's going to be completely different. But it's not. Like, you can apply many of the principles that you go through in your day-to-day life that you went through and did before the internet came along directly the same way. People want you to be transparent, they want you to be human, they want you to be honest. And if you make a mistake and you admit it and you resurrect that mistake, then people will forgive you. If you make a mistake and deny it or are defensive or aggressive in response, then obviously that's not going to garner popularity. So you're making people making people see that you're human, that your company is human or it's run by humans, that mistakes do happen. You can really actually build up more of a relationship with them rather than just trying to be this pretending that you never make any mistakes and get anything wrong. You seem like less of a machine, I think, by having this option. I think I completely agree with the article and with what you've just said, Greg. Yeah.
And in terms of psychology, you also give a little power to your customers, whether they realize it or not. If you make a mistake, they complain about it, and you work to fix it, you give them the power to forgive you. And they like that power, usually.
Yeah.
That's a little sneaky psychology trick. I mean, not everything can be forgiven. Like, if you ruined somebody's wedding by, I don't know, you gave them a raw cake or something like that, you might not be coming back from that one.
Yeah, so sometimes there's no coming back. But
if you sell them a rice cooker and, like, it has a missing part or it broke or something, instead of going, wow, you know, we sent it perfectly, obviously something happened and it was your fault or something like that, that's not going to go over so well. But if you go, man, I'm really sorry about that, and I, you know, we're not really sure what happened, but it's clear the mistake is our end, we'll make it right, send you a new one, priority ship that thing so they get it in the next day or two, follow up with them to see if everything was fine, they're going to go, yeah, thanks for taking care of it so quick. You know, I really appreciate what you did for me.
There's this company that they're called Blaze, and they basically make this bike light, which is pretty cool. I got one. Like projects like a green bike onto the floor in front of you, so at junctions, cars can see you coming. But what's interesting about them is that they launched the product and they talked to the initial group of people that were interested in purchasing this product. So you put in your orders before it even came out. They talked you through the process. They involved people in the development stage of that product. And then they also made a lot of mistakes because they were launching something completely new. It was a startup. But they were just completely honest about it. So they one of their parts didn't quite fit properly. So they sent everyone a brand new one. Something went sort of a bit wrong with my one, so I sent them a message and I got this for instantly, and I just got a very personal and helpful like message back. And it's just made me absolutely love that company and feel some affinity to it and feel part of it, which is obviously it's just a success story of a company using community from the very beginning very well.
And finally, this one isn't going to apply to many of us, I think, in the community management space, but it's the idea of combining technologies. It's focusing on the Home Shopping Network and how they're transitioning to the online space and still differentiating themselves from other online competitors. I don't think any of us are TV retail giants, so we'll just go over this one real quick. The thing that I think is the key takeaway from this portion is we have audiences and we have reach, and if we pick the right partners, we can generate an unbelievable amount of attention and community activity around our brand. And this is ironically someone whose name is Brand, Mr. Bill Brand. This is key, and I want to highlight the one particular part of it is pick the right partners. If you're in the community space, and if you're in the social media space, you do have some direct competitors. But chances are there's not as many of them as you think. And chances are you guys are not in a zero-sum game. So in other words, if you help each other, you can potentially both grow your audiences, both grow your profits, both grow your products. It's rare that you guys are going to be directly competing for the same limited pool of customers in the same exact space. If you're doing that, it might be a sign that your company needs to differentiate itself or its product somehow anyway. So just take advantage of it. Find companies that you think are reliable. Find companies that share your values or share a value add to a product that you do. And reach out to them. Do events together. Retweet each other's stuff. I do this as a podcaster all the time. My other podcast that I run some gaming podcasts. One of the best things you can do is to have other podcast hosts come on your show. A, it's a lot of fun because they're podcasters and they like to talk just like you like to talk. So those episodes are always great. There's never any like awkward silences. And the other nice thing about it is they go back to their show and they say, yeah, just the other day I was on Greg's podcast and we talked about blank and a blank. Maybe you should go over there and check it out. I get some of their listeners. And when they're on my show, they'll plug their show. So they get some of my listeners. We're not, I mean, in a sense, we're competing over them, but it's a somewhat friendly competition. Just because they're listening to my podcast doesn't mean they can't listen to the other guy's podcast. But I want to have as many listeners as possible. They want to have as many listeners as possible. And we both want to make sure that the content for our shows is good. So I go on their shows, they'll go on my shows. And the point is to have a good show and promote it as best you can. For the same reason, you as a company, you want to reach out and find good companies that you can rely on or build relationships with and take those relationships into the community space, into the social media space.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't have much to add to this, to be honest, but I agree with what you just said there. It's interesting that on the Feverly course, we kind of do that because on the course we have guest lecturers who come in every Wednesday. Those of you who've taken the course will know. And so we were talking about Jen from Moz before. We also had like Nir Eyal, who gave an amazing talk. And it's a great way for them to, A, you know, plug themselves, their company, what they offer. But also it's great for us because it shows our affinity with them and those companies. And also the fact that they think that Feverly is a cool place to come and speak. They want to do it. So that gives us, makes us look good and feel good too. So yeah, it's definitely, hooking up with people and rather than trying to go it alone, I think definitely can often lead to much more success stories.
And with that, we're going to close out the show. Join us next week for another episode, and it'll be myself, and I don't know, I think we should need to have like a wheel that we spin for who from Feverby is going to join me for the week. But
yeah,
if Richard maybe is back from gallivanting around the world, maybe we'll have him here.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, thanks for having me, Community Geeks, and Greg, thank you for having me. It's been fun, and I think these podcasts are a great thing. They're really enjoyable, so I look forward to hearing the next one.
Absolute pleasure, Callum. All right, everybody. Have a good week.